This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1021, A Conversation with Gregory Wright. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1021, A Conversation with Gregory Wright. I was very lucky to have Greg record for the podcast recently. We talked about his career in comics, both as a colorist and as a writer, amongst other duties he's had. This was really interesting and fun to kind of talk about what it was like to kind of navigate the 90s in particular, and, you know, writing books and also, you know, working on staff and then also being a colorist, the transition between them. So I'm always curious to hear from people about the kind of the 90s period of comics, and this does not disappoint in any way. So you can, if you want to, you can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever you want to call it. You can also listen to us on Spotify. Happy New Year's, everyone. This is coming out, I guess, extremely late on the 30th. And then upcoming episodes will include a conversation with Jim Zub, Al Milgrom being back on the show, hopefully having Mike Rockwitz, who was an editor and colorist in the Marvel in the 90s. We're going to have another Book of the Month Club looking back at the actual 90s Clone Saga. This time was the last time we talked about the 70s Clone Saga. So we're going to start making our way through the Clone Saga through those. And another episode with my wife is upcoming as well. So a lot of stuff on the horizon. You can, So hopefully, I was going to say you can email me at blah, 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 but I already did that. So without further ado, let's jump right into a conversation with Gregory Wright. Enjoy. Gregory, welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very good. Excited to talk to you. I'm always excited to kind of go back into, you know, that 90s comic book period in particular, to talk to people who were there and what their thoughts were at the time. So I'm very excited to talk to you about it. What were your kind of first recollections of kind of being at Marvel in terms of the editorial? Obviously, if people have look you up, they'll know that you were more of an aspiring filmmaker, not necessarily looking to jump into comics, and you kind of got roped into it, but you kind of got into it with D.G. Chichester kind of getting you into the fold, so to speak. But what was it like to kind of get to Marvel?
You know, I was really very lucky because at the time that I was at Marvel, it was just filled with, you know, some of the best people in comics. And I started at Epic Comics, so, you know, my bosses were Archie Goodwin, mm-hmm. Joe Duffy, and Margaret Clark, and my friend Dan, DG, was an assistant editor there. And, you know, we were working on Elektra Assassin, you know, Frank Miller and Bill Sienkiewicz, and Moonshadow with J.M. DeMatteis and John J. Muth. Sergio Aragones was around doing Gru. So, you know, I kind of started out working with like the cream of the crop of the industry. And, you know, at Epic, it was all creator owned. So they're, you know, what they were trying to do is make sure that the comics that they did were coming out the very best they could print wise and everything for what the creators were wanting. And that was kind of different than when I moved over to the Marvel side to be Mark Gruenwald's assistant. Because Marvel editors essentially were in charge of the material and they didn't necessarily tell the creators that they were making changes. Mm-hmm. They just demanded changes be made. They made them themselves. They could just erase pages or panels of stuff and have somebody fix it. You know, famously, you know, there's a lot of John Romita drawn heads floating around in comics. And, you know, John Romita hated doing that. You know, he was, you know, told that was his job, was to redraw Peter Parker heads all the time. And he hated it. You know, he had a lot more respect for the art than the editors kind of had. So I was very surprised, you know, at the difference. And I tried to bring a little more sort of respect to the creators that they had at Epic into Marvel, which Mark Gruenwald really appreciated because it meant – that a lot more creators actually wanted to work with us all the time because they knew they were going to be treated, you know, better. But, you know, again, you know, the editorial staff, you know, we had, you know, Mark Grunewald and Larry Hama and Carl Potts and Bob Budiansky. Tom DeFalco was the executive editor at the time. And Annie Nesenti was, you know, was an editor. People like, you know, Walt Simonson were just hanging around the office all the time. You know, so I was just constantly working with some of the best people. So it was, you know, it's like a fantasy to work with so many phenomenally talented people who are also really nice people, and they were very willing to teach this young, you know, punk at the time who didn't know anything about comics. I knew filmmaking, but they were very patient and taught me anything I wanted to learn. You know, I mean, you know, I could, you know, talk to Klaus Janson and Tom Palmer anytime I wanted about color. You know, I could talk to Frank Miller about writing. It was crazy to just, these are just became part of my life that was normal. Plus you get to, you know, you get to look at all the art that, you know, fans didn't get to see. At that time, you never saw the pencils of John Buscema or, you know, of Mark Silvestri or John Byrne. You saw finished, you know, pages. We got to see them and hold them and make giant Xeroxes of them and stare at them as long as we wanted. You know, it was pretty much a fantasy come true that I didn't realize would be so great. You know, I didn't intend to stick around in comics when I got there. You know, both DG and I wanted to be the next sort of Martin Scorsese cross with Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we very quickly realized that, you know, comics were really fun and they were awesome. And everything that we learned in film school, we could apply that to the comics. And that's the thing that made both of us a lot more successful than we might have been just, you know, coming out of some other area. Because for us, it was all about telling a story visually and writing stories that were meant to be told visually. And for me, you know, I did a lot of cinematography in college. So, you know, I tried to apply that sort of thinking to the color that I did. The creators really enjoyed that somebody was putting that other effort in that hadn't been there before. And the writers like to see, you know, oh, look, he's trying to tell the story in color. So, you know, it seems like a simple thing, but a lot of people really weren't doing that at the time.
I'm curious in general, like it felt like obviously the editorial ethos was very different in the 80s and 90s, where people who kind of moved through editorial were, you know, in a lot of ways expected that they would end up becoming freelancers or writers of their own or, you know, colorists like yourself. And Mark Bernardo did a lot of coloring as well. So there's a lot of people who started in editorial and sort of migrated into these other avenues that they were first exposed to through editorial. Did that feel really natural to you when it happened?
Well, you know, okay, for one thing is, you know, at the time I was on staff, editors and assistant editors were paid shit. So you know, everybody loved their job, but you weren't really paid a lot. And you're living in New York or near New York, so it costs a lot of money. So it was essential to get some freelance work in order to just survive. So a lot of the people on staff, that's what they did. But, you know, you got to look at guys like Larry Hama, who, you know, could write, he could draw, he could pencil, he could ink, he could color. He could do everything. Bob Budiansky could do everything. Mark Grunewald could do everything. Carl Potts could do everything. So these are people that, you know, they didn't start out as editors and then became creators. These are people that started out as creators, became editors, continued to do creative work. And, you know, unfortunately, because, you know, you really weren't paid such a great amount of money, you found that, you know, as an editor, you were getting a lot more work, you know, as a freelancer, and it was more satisfying. And if you did more of that work, you would probably make even more money. So that's what would happen is a lot of people would leave staff just and go freelance. You know, what was one of the reasons that I did leave was I was making so much more money just doing part-time freelance compared to what I was making on staff. The funny thing is, after I left staff, they started to realize this was a bit of a problem. So they started giving editors a royalty, but an incentive for how their books sold, which I was like, really? You wait till I leave? but, you know, I didn't really work on what I call the hit books. I was working on a lot of, you know, when I was an editor, I was working on a lot of Epic books, and they didn't really sell tremendous numbers. You know, I was about the quality of the books, and I worked on books I was really interested in, but none of them, they weren't doing X-Men numbers or Spider-Man numbers or Punisher numbers. So I probably wouldn't have made any more money as it was. And, you know, and it sounds crass, but, you know, it is a job. Mm-hmm. And you need to earn a living. And, you know, once I went freelance, you know, I got all the color work I could ever hope for, and I got all the writing work I could ever hope for. And I absolutely loved my freelance career. But when I left, I took a bunch of stuff with me to freelance edit, which was an interesting experience because the second I wasn't there in the office, people would take advantage of not doing things for my books because I wasn't there to, you know, enforce getting the work done. And, you know, I had an assistant that was in the office that I paid separately, and, you know, they would take advantage of him. And so I would have to, you know, come up from Virginia, where I was living at the time, and you know, sort of kick a bit of ass to make sure things happened the way they were supposed to. You know, and there would be meetings I wasn't privy to, you know, then I would have to come up. But I did a pretty good job freelance because I made sure that the work that my creators were doing, because I did the Hellraiser Nightbreed crossover Jihad. Mm-hmm. Freelance. I did a graphic novel with Jim Starlin and Joe Chido freelance. Carl Potts and Gary Erskine did a Punisher Wolverine series for me freelance. And they worked, ultimately they worked out well, but you know, the office didn't always cooperate. So I would have to go up and have discussions.
When you are expanding more into, you know, again, being a freelance colorist, I mean, first of all, like, what was it about being a colorist that really spoke to you and was a right fit for you? Because you've done some amazing color work over the years, so obviously it very much agreed with you and was the right move for you. But I'm just curious, like, when you knew that that was the right path? Because it's a very specialized field, and I find often you're either really good at it or you're not. I guess there is some, you know, people kind of in the middle, but for the most part, it feels like, you know, comics really need that colorist to really sell it. I think almost in modern comics more so, because there's more heavy lifting in the colors than as people's backgrounds at times get a little bit more sparse. But I feel like in your kind of heyday in the 90s, color was really starting to even more so sell a book.
Okay, that's a bit to unpack.
It was a lot, sorry.
You know, it was a matter of, you know, I needed to get to do some freelance work in order to survive. So of course, you know, what I really wanted to be doing was writing, but it's a lot more difficult to actually sell a comic book story than it is to do anything else, because everybody thinks they can write, but you can't. You know, a lot of people, they just can't. And, you know, editors don't always, you know, and everybody wants to write, so there's a lot more competition. So I was, you know, trying to sell stories in writing, and I wasn't having quite as fast a success as I wanted. But I tried everything. You know, penciling was not going to be for me because I can't really draw. I can tell a story, but the drawing is really poor. I tried inking, and, you know, that was really fun to pull out, you know, one of the ink pens and try to draw a line on it, and the ink would just splatter everywhere. I tried lettering, and I just hated that. That was very difficult. So, you know, color, you know, was something that I was correcting color, you know, on the books when I was an assistant editor all the time. And I thought, you know, this looks terrible. And I was constantly fixing bad color. And, you know, because of my background in film and cinematography, I understood color on a different level. You know, I understood storytelling with color. I understood how to use color to make an image pop and all the things. It just was something that came very natural to me. So when I started doing it, you know, it just felt very natural. And I started saying, well, what if I applied my cinematographer brain to this? You know, because a lot of the cinematography that I liked in movies, you know, was very color driven, you know, and I just started doing that. So I would, you know, every scene had a different sort of color scheme to it. And, you know, editors didn't quite know what to make of that at first because they were so accustomed to everybody coloring, you know, Captain America, those specific red, white, and blue colors. And suddenly I'm altering the blue and the red and the white so that it looks different because it's, you know, in orange light or red light or it's blue light, it's nighttime. And the creators, the artists, they absolutely loved it because, again, it was color storytelling. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was just kind of a natural fit for me. And, you know, the day I figured it out was there was an issue of Merc. I think it might be issue 5 or so, that Jim Owsley had been fired by Jim Shooter, who was on a firing rampage. And his assistant at the time, Adam, who became Maddie Blaustein, had to get this issue out in like 4 days or they'd be fired. So they gathered whoever was around, and we literally, we had Doug Murray's full script, you know, that was all scripted, and we had Mark Beecham's layouts. So whoever was around, we light boxed all the pages up and penciled up the pages as breakdowns, then inked them, then Rick Parker lettered them, and then two or three of us colored them. And it was crazy because, you know, you had Bill Sienkiewicz and Walt Simonson and Dennis Cowan and anybody that was in the bullpen mm-hmm. light boxing up pages or inking, you know, for an hour on pages. And then there was several people that did a lot more inking. And the only inking I could really do was I ruled panel borders with the rapidograph and I filled in blacks. And there's some backgrounds in there that I did manage to ink with a rapidograph. So that was an interesting thing. But when we sat down to do the coloring at the end, it was very natural to me. And we were trying to tell a story because it was me, Adam, and John Wellington who colored the entire issue, you know, in an evening. And that kind of solidified, oh, I really like this. And the more of it I did, the more I liked it. And the more creators enjoyed what I was doing. That's like what, you know, when somebody like Alan Davis says, oh, I really like what you did on my work, you won't get a much better compliment than that. So that kind of solidified it. You know, and it came pretty easily to me at the time.
Now, in that early period, in the early 90s, as you start, you know, freelancing, you also are writing. So you're writing Silver Sable, you're writing, I think, Ghost Rider for a bit.
No, I wrote Silver Sable, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., yeah. Deathlok, Morbius. I wrote a Spider-Man series. I wrote some Punisher stuff. Mm-hmm. I wrote some Daredevil. I wrote a She-Hulk with Richard Starkings. And some the Deathlok I wrote with Dwayne McDuffie. So I was writing. I was writing like 4 books at a time while I was coloring.
Wow!
And I don't know how I did all that work. I really don't. That was a very bad idea to do all that. But it didn't. You know, I had stories in my head, so it was really easy to get them out there. And at the time, you know, coloring was a lot more simple, so I was very fast at using my technique to do, you know, whole books overnight. Mm-hmm. But as it progressed, you know, because I was there when coloring was being done pretty much the way it's been done forever, and it kind of progressed into, well, you can now have an extra shade of color, and then, oh, you can have 10 shades of each color, and, oh, now you can have a little bit airbrushed, oh, now you can have a few special effects, and everything they added made my page rate go up, but it also made it take me longer. Mm. So, you know, it would get to a point where I couldn't, color, and again, they would go to a separator who would ruin them, which was just that would kill you because it would come out and you're like, this looks like crap, and it, you know, you look at the guides and you look at what they did or what they didn't do, because a lot of times they would leave out a lot of the detail that you put into the guides, so you had to kind of, you know, you didn't know who was going to do the separations, and you know, eventually it got to a point where, you know, we didn't have to code the colors or anything, but that was dangerous because, you know, 10 different people were doing the separations on any given book, so you would have they would all interpret the colors differently. So I went back to coding again until we finally were able to start doing the color on the computer ourselves. Which takes me a much longer time because it's very fast when I had a lot of limitations. Mm. Second, I can do anything I want. Now I'm overthinking everything. And I don't like, you know, I never like the color that sort of takes over the art. I think the black and white art is pretty sacred, and you need to enhance that art, not redraw it with color. And I've seen a lot of colorists who are they're really talented, but they're rendering it different than the artist rendered it, which is kind of redrawing the art. Or they're doing really fancy, cool looking stuff on a page where somebody's just getting up to make breakfast, and it really shouldn't look that dramatic. So there's, you know, you have to kind of figure out when to restrain yourself and when to let loose. And that's one of those things that a lot of the old school artists really appreciated about my work, because I didn't try to take over, and I still don't. I prefer to let the art, you know, speak for itself. It should look just as good as their art's going to look. But now we actually talk on the phone. You know, like Graham Nolan and I talk on the talk and go back and forth with pages. Every time I finish a page, I send it to him. And if he's got something he doesn't, Lezer doesn't like, then I can fix it. So at this point, he and I have been working together long enough. I know what he doesn't like. I know what he does like. So it's very rare that there's something that doesn't really work. And the thing is, every time something doesn't work, we talk about it, and I redo it, and I go, wow, that looks so much better. Having that sort of second eye on it to do that. So,
what was it like actually with him working on Bane Conquest? Because obviously that meant a lot to him.
It was a lot of fun, you know, because, you know, he was doing the full artwork, and DC kind of let us do whatever we were going to do. So it really wasn't different than anything else I work on, because, you know, we function the same as we function on a creator-owned project. Graham did what Graham did. It came to me. I did what I did. DC never came back and said, hey, what are you doing? They were very happy with what we were doing. So, I mean, it was really good.
Yeah, it was a very fun project from beginning to end, and it felt very much like their vision as to what they wanted to do. And that, yeah, as you said, it didn't feel like it was meddled with.
Story Chuck and Graham wanted to tell, and DC let them tell it, which was really nice.
So I have to ask, only because Tom Brevoort has said that the relative short-lived nature of the Deathlok book in the 90s was his complete failure as an editor, and that he kind of takes responsibility for it, and that he learned a lot of things not to do because of how he handled that book. So I'm curious what the experience was working on it.
You know, it's one of those strange things, because everything that could have gone wrong with Deathlok constantly seemed to go wrong. So when we were doing the original limited series, me and Dwayne, Butch Geiss was the artist that, you know, I had gotten us to get Butch in, and then he quit halfway through, and we had to get somebody else. And I desperately tried to find somebody that whose style was similar to Butch's. And nobody wanted to follow Butch Geiss, but Dennis Cowan really wanted to do the book. He loved Deathlok. But, you know, and we love Dennis's stuff. Dennis's stuff was awesome. Dennis is one of my favorite artists. But his stuff doesn't look anything like Butch's. No. And generally, when you have a limited series, you want the artwork to kind of mesh. But we couldn't find anybody. Finally, we said, all right, you know, let's go with the guy that's going to do a kick-ass job. And we'll just have to hope that the readers accept it. And Dennis, I think he did like a whole 48-page issue in like 2 weeks. And it was beautiful. So that was the end of us thinking that was a problem. And the readers didn't seem to mind it so much until the fourth issue, when Rick Magyar, who was inking Dennis, couldn't ink it. And Dennis said, well, let's get Kyle Baker, you know, and Kyle's a genius. Kyle's great. And I don't know what he was thinking, but it looked like he, you know, inked it with a magic marker in his ear or something. So then we had to hire a whole bunch of other inkers just to finish it off. So it's this very sort of cobbled together mess, and, you know, and for me, and you know, plus it had gotten on the schedule and they made it late, so I was never able to color a full issue. I had to have Dwayne script issues 2 and 3, so that I could try to get as much colored. So it, you know, a lot of this, it just was, you know, like and then when, so then, you know, but it sold well enough, and they said, okay, we're gonna do the regular series, and I'm like, okay, good. So then I moved. And Dwayne and I kind of realized that writing the book together, because this is back before we had the internet and Skype and stuff, you know, that was, you know, made it easy to work together. It was going to cost us more money to communicate, to write the book, than we would make. So, you know, Bob and Tom kind of came up with this idea that, well, you know, we'll write the first issue together and then we will do separate arcs of the book. And that was kind of the beginning of where there was a bit of a problem here, because Dwayne and I kind of wrote it just different enough that readers could tell. And that's, you know, the one place where, you know, Bob was overseeing Tom, because Tom was starting to, he was going to be the editor. Tom was the editor, but Bob was kind of overseeing him. Hmm. And what would happen is both Dwayne and I would work out what we wanted to do with Tom. And you know, we'd be happy, Tom would be happy, and then Bob would turn around and go, no, I don't like this. And he would, you know, overrule everything that Tom just did with us. That was a problem. And then, Dennis Cowan's work, which we were so happy to have, he started doing weird experimental stuff, and then he started being really late on the book, which we couldn't quite figure out. And you know, something had to be done, and you know, we had to ultimately replace him, and we had samples from an artist who, it just looked like it was amazing stuff, the samples, and then we hired him, and then he couldn't tell a story, so I had to have pages redrawn of his stuff. I had to rewrite everything as full script because he couldn't work from a plot. Then he was late all the time, and this is where, you know, Tom didn't make whatever hard decisions he probably should have made, but you know, he was brand new, you know, and Tom was my intern and Dwayne's intern to begin with. So now our ex-intern is now our boss. So that's got to be awkward for Tom, you know, so whatever decisions that maybe he should have made on the book, he didn't make. I don't blame him at all. I blame the circumstances of, you know, the artists, not living up to, you know, not Dennis. I don't blame Dennis. You know, I mean, that basically Dwayne and Dennis were working on the Milestone at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's probably why Dennis was late, because, you know, Dennis was always very reliable. But, you know, Tom fired him at the wrong moment, you know, and then the next artist didn't work out. And then there was like four or five different artists on Dwayne's last story arc before he left the book to go do Milestone. And things didn't kind of settle into a normal thing until Dwayne left the book, and it was just me and Kevin Kobasic came on the book. But there was just like about a year or so of chaos, and I don't really blame Tom. I mean, sometimes stuff just gets out of your control. What Tom could have done, that, you know, was he could have decided that either I was writing the book or Dwayne was writing the book, so there was only one writer. You know, that he could have done that. But I don't know what he would have done with the artists, because he hired people that were, you know, that should have been dependable and then weren't. Mm-hmm. So it just, I think it's just stuff that happens. And, you know, he's sort of gracious at taking all the blame, but, you know, we were all to blame on that book. You know, Dwayne and I not really communicating as well as we probably should have together, so that the book was a little more cohesive from that standpoint. We were always on time, at least, you know, that that was one thing that Tom did have. He had both of us writing on time. But you know, getting the art done in the right way. But you know, then by the time, you know, we kind of evened it out, the book wasn't selling as well. And that wound up getting, you know, getting canceled, which was unfortunate, because right after Dwayne left is when we finally got permission to use the original Deathlok, Luther Manning. Mm-hmm. So I kind of brought that character in. And, you know, it's a strange thing. You know, the Deathlok was this dream project for me, and it just, so many things just went wrong that were out of everybody's control. I don't really know if Tom could have solved any of it other than, you know, hiring, you know, after Dennis, hiring an artist that was going to stay on the book and be dependable, but I don't know who he would have hired. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious.
I don't blame Tom for any of it at all. he takes the blame, and I'll shoulder some of the blame. You know, Dwayne can have a little bit of the blame, but honestly, you know, artists not, you know, turning in, doing the work that they were supposed to do. And you know, also having, you know, Bob, when Bob was overseeing Tom, you know, they weren't in agreement, and, you know, it was very frustrating to write a story change things up for Tom, and then have Bob come in and say, no, we're going to change it back to this. It's like, well, you know, why didn't you guys talk about this before we got in here? So that was just frustrating. But yeah, I don't blame Tom at all. I think he's wrong for taking so much blame. I don't blame him. I'll take more of the blame.
I'm curious what it was like for you as, you know, a guy who's, again, really expanding his work as a freelancer, and then you start getting not just a few DC projects, but, like, particularly seminal ones that are really looked back extremely fondly today. Like, you work on Zero Hour, Crisis in Time, which, again, was a great Dan Jurgens book, and so you're providing colors there. You're working on Superman, Doomsday, Hunter, Prey. You end up, you know, being the guy who's the color artist in Starman, which is extremely impactful for a lot of people and remains, you know, a lot of people's kind of favorite DC book. You do some incredible work with Tim Sale on the Batman color books. So I'm really curious what it was like, you know, kind of crossing across the street, so to speak, and then to be tapped to be the main color artist on so many projects which really have stood the test of time.
Well, you know, what's interesting is when I left staff, I asked Marvel for a contract, and they said, no, we're not going to give you a contract. And I said, oh, okay. And then very quickly after I went freelance, I got a phone call from Diana Schutz over at Dark Horse, who had heard that I'd left staff and wanted to know if I was exclusive to Marvel. And I said, no, they didn't give me a contract. And she had offered me this Terminator. I think it was, might have been Endgame or Secondary. I don't remember but it was a Terminator project that Paul Galassi was drawing. And
that's right, yeah.
And the Starman writer.
Robinson?
Yeah, James Robinson was writing. And you know, that was the first sort of toe out of the Marvel pond, and that worked out really well. And you know, James loved the work I did because I was trying to tell the story with color as well, and he picked up on that. And that was a big deal for James. So once I did that project, DC noticed, hey. I was happy to know that they actually had noticed my work on Marvel stuff. They wanted to do something. Now, the other fun part is my first boss at Marvel was Archie Goodwin. Mm. And I worked with Archie, after I left Epic, I wound up editing Archie on the Archie Goodwin, Howard Chaykin graphic novel, Nick Fury Wolverine, the Scorpio connection.
Oh, man.
So when Archie left Marvel and went to DC, he called me to work on some of the Tim Sale Batman stuff. And then when Starman came up, I had met Tony Harris at a convention. I had said, I got to get you work on Marvel. I think he was doing a lot of really cool horror stuff. I said, I got to get you on Hellraiser. And then all of a sudden I got offered a 3-issue story arc on Nightbreed. And I went, hey, let's get Tony Harris. So they hired Tony to do that. So when Starman came up, I had Archie, James, and Tony all three at the same time wanted me to color the book. so I wound up over there at DC. But everybody thought I would only work with Archie, and I was like, no, that's not true, because I really wanted to work with Mike Carlin because I'd liked him over at Marvel, and I really liked what he was doing on the Superman books. And you know, Mike had gotten caught, you know, Mike had called me at one point to get me on some of those other big projects, you know, a lot of the crossover projects. And he had, hooked me up with, Eddie Braganza on, Titans. And that hooked me up with Dan Jurgens, which led to a whole bunch of projects I did with Dan. You know, Dan did all those big crossovers. And one of my favorite things I did with Dan was Superman Aliens that Kevin Nolan inked.
Oh yeah.
But that was scary to color because Kevin is so brilliant, and he's a brilliant painter. He's a brilliant colorist, and I've been friends with Kevin for years. And I thought, oh my God, what if I ruin this book over with Kevin Nolan inks? But fortunately, you know, my style and what Kevin was doing, Kevin would have done it differently, but he really liked what I did. And that was a big deal. And, you know, but it was funny because I told Dan, I said, you know, Kevin's going to redraw your stuff. And he goes, oh yeah, who doesn't want to be redrawn by Kevin Nolan? I said, okay. but yeah, so it was, you know, and from there, you know, I got, you know, after working at Dark Horse with Diana, I did lots of projects at Dark Horse. And then when Eric Larson left Spider-Man to go form Image, he asked me to come along and do the Savage Dragon, which I did. And then Marvel got mad. And they were like, you're how could you do this to us? How could you go work for Image? And I said, okay. So Eric's my friend. I said, so you're telling me I shouldn't work with my friend? Eric's paying me twice as much as you are. Eric's got me better separators. Eric's given me a proper deadline. He said, can you offer me any of these things? No. And they said, have I actually left any of the work I'm doing for you? No. And I said, well, maybe you just need to shut up. My working with Eric at Image has no effect on Marvel or anything you've done. I said, if you don't want me working elsewhere, you need to provide me with projects I want to do. And it was a nice period because it was like a fantasy. I could work anywhere I wanted on any project I wanted. And I thought, wow, this is not going to last forever. And it didn't. But, while it was happening, it was really nice, because, creators all wanted to work with me. Editors like work with me. Part of it is, being dependable and being the guy that the creators like and the fans liked it. So that it was really nice to, to be sort of universally loved, as a colorist at the time. That was something good.
I'm curious what it was. I mean, obviously the Tim Sale Batman books, Dark Victory, Long Halloween, Catwoman, When in Rome are so influential and, again, keep getting reprinted and probably will till the cows come home. But
yeah, I've got more copies of that stuff than anything else.
But your colors are such a huge part of really what helps feel, you really set the, obviously the visual tone is really carried out through the colors, but you also have such a sensibility in the art, which really kind of keeps it seedy, but also very lively. So I'm very curious what it was like working over Tim, because he has a very interesting visual style. And so how did you kind of approach it from a coloring perspective to do, as you said, kind of tell the story through the colors?
Well, Tim was a very dear friend, and he was one of my very favorite people to collaborate with, period. I love his work. I love the way he thinks. And again, this goes back to Diana Schutz of all people. She had sent me copies of a book that he had been doing called Billy 99. And she said, this is a guy you need to work with. And I thought, wow, I like this stuff, but I said, when is this going to happen? And when we were doing Batman Predator stuff, Tim had done a little mini poster, and she had said, well, Tim would like you to try this because Tim really likes what you're doing. I said, oh, okay. So I colored this Batman Predator pinup that he did, and I really enjoyed it. I thought this was really cool. And Tim really liked it. And, I was like, oh, Diana's going to find some project for us. And then just out of the blue, I get a call from Tim, and he says, you're going to get a FedEx package from me tomorrow. And I said, oh, he goes, it's this Batman project I just finished. And I would really like it if you colored it. And I was like, I don't know, man, I'm so booked right now. I said, this is terrible timing. He goes, well, do me a favor and just look at it. I said, okay. And the next day I opened it up, and it was the first Batman special that he and Jeff did. And I was just bowled over by everything I looked at. And everything I looked at, I just immediately had all these ideas of what I wanted to do. I just couldn't wait to start working on it. And I called him up, and I was like, you motherfucker. And I said, I can't say no to this. I said, this is like the best stuff I've ever seen. This is I really want to do this. This is going to be great. I said, the only problem is, I have to be offered the job by an editor. And he goes, well, Archie Goodwin is editing. So I said, well, you can tell Archie if he wants me, I'm in. But, Archie called me up, and, we solidified that. And, the first couple things I did over Tim, I colored it a little more traditionally, and much brighter. Tim was one of those artists that likes to change as he goes. So we kept altering how we worked together on stuff, because Tim's stuff to me looked like it was super high contrast. And he would say, no, it's the opposite. I want it. I know it looks like that, but I want it to be kind of grayish. you know, and more subdued. And I went, oh, great. And then so I kind of developed a style and he really liked it. And we did a whole lot of projects together up until he did Daredevil Yellow, mm-hmm. in which I had not yet started working on a computer. And it was funny, the way he wanted to work on that, he was going to do these black and white pages and then have them colorized. He was going to do like gray tones all over everything. Mm-hmm. And the reason he wanted to do that was he had done that on one of the issues, one of the Long Halloween issues. And Mark Chiarello, superhumanly talented painter and colorist that he is, was the art director over at DC. And he thought an image was really cool. And he just put it into his computer and colorized it just for fun. Tim saw that and he went, this is awesome. I want to do this. So Daredevil Yellow, originally, he thought he was going to be able to have Mark Chiarello do the colorization of his black and white sort of painted pages at Marvel. But, you know, Mark worked at DC and I thought, well, that's not going to fly. So I'll learn how to do this and, you know, keep me in mind. So sure enough, both Marvel and DC said, no, Mark can't do this. But Mark had showed me how to do it. So then they asked for sample pages. So I did sample pages. A whole bunch of people did sample pages. And ultimately, Tim chose Matt Hollingsworth to do it, which was a smart move on his part because I was pretty new to using the computer. Matt was a pro. Mm. And Matt, you know, to me, he's the absolute best colorist in the business today. And he's been that guy for, you know, forever. And I think he just did a brilliant job on that. So I you know, if I'm going to lose a job to, you know, and I was apparently the second choice. but, you know, if you're going to lose a job, losing one to Matt is not a bad thing. The only thing was, this happened at the same time Marvel decided to screw all the colorists and fired us and hired a bunch of studios to do color without ever telling the editors. So one day I got a phone call. I got five phone calls saying, oh, so, you know, you're no longer coloring this book. So that was very depressing, you know, to have that happen and then not get Tim's book mm-hmm. on that in rapid succession. So I was suddenly very humbled. But you know, DC kept me, they kept me pretty busy there. And then, and I did start to get, I mean, it kind of forced me to really up my game to do comics color separation. So I did started doing those at Marvel. And I got hand selected to do, Killraven by Alan Davis, which was a huge compliment. Cause you know, I think Alan's one of the finest artists, on the planet, and for him to actually asked for me, and he was thrilled with what I did, and sent me an original page. Actually, he sent me a page of artwork, which was the very first comic that Dwayne and I ever wrote, which was a Black Knight story for Solo Avengers that Alan penciled and Paul Neary inked. Mm-hmm. So he sent me that as a gift for what I did on Killraven. I thought, wow, this is crazy. This is literally the first real writing work I ever had, and I colored that story as well. But it's like what a fun piece of art to actually own, and it's a beautiful page. You know, it's Alan Davis.
It's incredible. So I have a few particular things you've worked on that I have some questions about, just in terms of, like, you know, in some cases. You know, like for particular, sorry, I'm apparently not good with words today. You were the colorist on Green Goblin, which was a book that, yes, I loved in the mid 90s.
Yes. Oh, I love that book.
You got Scott McDaniel. Actually, I just picked up a Scott McDaniel page about a year ago from,
yeah, Green. Scott's great. I love coloring Scott. He was fun.
So I'm curious what kind of challenge that was, because his style was very different than a lot of other people at the time. So I would imagine coloring him would have been not a challenge per se, but it would have been a little bit maybe different, because his art was not structured the way that a lot of pencilers were at the time. There was, it did not look like a house style. It looked like a Scott McDaniel style. So I'm curious what it was like working over him.
Well, you know, again, every time, and any, you know, either, you know, it's going to be happen true for any colorist or anchor. There are people whose work you look at and you kind of get it. And then there's people's work you look at and you go, what the hell am I going to do with this crap? And, you know, the trick with Scott was every once in a while, I wasn't quite sure what he meant, and I would just call him up and ask for an explanation. And, you know, ultimately, you know, I just had no problems with Scott's work. You know, I'd watched his works, you know, from his earlier work on Daredevil. And, you know, I really liked this, you know, sort of Frank Miller crossed with, you know, Todd McFarlane and I don't know how many different people style that he came up with. I just got it. And, you know, it was a fun story to do. And, you know, it was nice that I got to do another thing that's been printed a billion times is Nightwing Year One. Mm-hmm. That Scott did on that, that I did. I got to do the color separations on that one. So that was even more fun to do that. But yeah, I always kind of got Scott. I loved it. I love his work now. Loved it then. It wasn't difficult to do, you know. And I like people who have a little more style to them because you can do a little more with it. Mm. Whereas, you know, when you get somebody whose work you have to, if you don't really get in there and render it, it doesn't look like much. That's just no fun to me. I like to look at the black and white and go, wow, this doesn't need me. How do I not screw it up? Is, you know, much better than, wow, there's nothing here. I'm going to have to save this page. And I've done that. You know, I mean, I had editors send me crappy artwork and say, can you make it look like Jim Lee? You know, like, no, I can't make it look like Jim Lee. Well, color it like you would color Jim. And I'm like, no, I can't color it like a color Jim because Jim puts a lot of lighting and has structure and storytelling and can really draw. And this is crap. You know, I'm not going to redraw the art in color. You know, I mean, what a stupid thing to ask somebody. I mean, I have people say, make it look like Todd McFarlane. No, it doesn't. Nobody looks like Todd McFarlane. You know, I color Todd the way I color Todd. I colored Tim the way I colored Tim. I colored, you know, Scott the way I colored Scott. You know, it just doesn't work that way. You know, everybody's, you know, I've got a similar palette that I use. But, you know, like the guys that were more realistic artists, a lot of them I colored very similar. You know, I colored, you know, the Kuberts and Lee Weeks and Ron Wagner and Ron Garney very similar because they all come from that same sort of, you know, really well-drawn comics school and really dramatic storytelling. So it was easy to color them because everything you needed was there. I could just sort of put my touch on it. But there were guys out there that, you know, there was that point where people were kind of drawing almost nothing on the page and you were expected to, you know, turn it into a masterpiece. And that was not me. And that's still not me. I don't really want to do that.
Hmm. I'm curious. So you said before how, you know, especially in this kind of mid-90s period, you start working with Dan Jurgens a fair bit. One project I'm very curious what it was like for you to color it is when Dan was doing Sensational Spider-Man, because you had Klaus Janson, who was a very different line than Breeding yeah. typically would on Jurgens. So it almost looks like a completely different artist is doing that book. So how did you approach coloring it? Because the art does look fundamentally different because of what Klaus is bringing to the book.
I colored it just the way I would color Klaus, mostly because, you know, what the inking that Klaus did on that made it, I mean, the drawing underneath didn't look like Klaus, but the lighting and the sort of black and white structure was very Klaus. So I just kind of, you know, Klaus was very easy to color. I mean, when Klaus did it, it was a lot more simple. Mm. Dan doesn't do simple art. He puts a lot of stuff. You know, Dan's kind of from the John Byrne, George Perez sort of way of doing things where you draw a lot of stuff. And, you know, Klaus is more I hate to say Mike Mignola as, but Klaus is much simpler, more blocky shapes and stuff. So it was an interesting contrast. But yeah, I kind of just was like, okay, I'll color this the way I would color anything Klaus does. I mean, it's the same thing if Tom Palmer was inking something. There was a way I liked to color Tom Palmer, which was essentially the way Tom Palmer would color Tom Palmer, because Tom was a big help when I was learning to be a better colorist. Tom was helping me learn a lot of those things because, you know, Tom was a brilliant painter as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, Tom's color guides, you know, if you ever get to see what his stuff looked like on Tomb of Dracula that he was coloring and inking over Gene Colan, it's just gorgeous stuff. And Tom understood when coloring was simple, much like Bernie Wrightson and his wife Michelle understood, was how to use those simple colors in a way that made the pages almost look painted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they just had the same stupid little colors we had, but between the brilliant artwork and using the color more effectively, I learned a lot from the, and Bernie Wright's another guy, great, he's really fun to work with. And I learned a lot from looking at their work and talking to them and say, well, why did you do that? And, you know, Tom Palmer was always had, there was always a lot of theoretical why he chose these colors. And, you know, he was right, because you have to, you know, you want the, you know, if you can't just color a page blue, you have to put some red or some white on the page. Otherwise it doesn't actually look blue, even though it's just blue. Mm-hmm. And it's really funny when you do these little tiny things that are part of art theory, it makes things pop and look even better. So that was kind of good. I don't know if that even answers the question.
I think it does. Question, as you go on and you're doing more and more of the Spider-Man books, and I think at one point, I think you were doing all four of them, weren't you?
At some point I've done all of the books, you know, I mean, sometimes there was crossovers and I was going, it's, you know, it's funny. I was going through comics that I had not put in my archive that I worked on, and I go, wow, I don't even know what I was working on half the time, because they kept changing the titles of Spider-Man books. Mm-hmm. But I, at some point or other, I have worked on every Spider-Man title at that point. But I don't think all at once. I don't think I ever worked on all four at once. I'm pretty sure I worked on at least two at once, because, you know, I did one. Howard Mackey was doing one, and at one point, Romita Jr. was on it. At one point, Byrne was on it.
That's
and then
right, yeah.
Nick Jurgens had his with Klaus. And then Mike Waringo, another phenomenal guy to work with, did a run. So yeah, it gets kind of and a lot of very different art. You know, John Romita Jr. is another guy whose work I love working on his stuff, and it just spoke to me, especially when Al Williamson was inking his stuff. Mm. But you know, and Klaus, when you know Klaus over John Romita Jr., man, that was just the best stuff to color, because I had, you know, I love John's pencils, and then suddenly had Klaus's awesome inks on top of it. And you know, Klaus would change stuff, but you know, it was still very much John Romita Jr., but with Klaus, you know, so it was this fantastic combination.
I'm curious, when you're doing like, you know, two Spider-Man books at a time, so obviously there's a visual consistency because it's still Spider-Man's world, but at the same time, you're very different artists. Like, for example, as you said, you're kind of doing Waringo and you're doing Romita Jr. at the same month, and they're very different styles visually. So what is it like to work on books throughout a line? And again, as I said, try to thread that needle of keeping it consistent to the world, but also still making it unique to the artist, who is different from the other artist on the other book.
I just kind of had in my head certain kinds of, you know, palettes of color that I would use with different people. You know, it's like if I was doing Tim Sale, I didn't use any bright colors. You know, it's all dim, dark, dull colors. On Romita Jr., I preferred to use similar to that, but with a few colors here and there. Ringo, I tended to be a little brighter with. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's just like when you know what you think it should look like. So it's hard to sort of intellectualize it. You know, I just sort of did it. And now I look back at some of it and I think, well, I would do that differently today. And then there's stuff I look back and I go, well, I should do more of that. You know, why don't I do more of that now? But you know, again, some of it was just, it's done so fast, that you know, I don't have time to think of it. So I would sort of come up with my simple, this is how this book looks. This is the sort of colors I use on this. It's like I colored Eric Larson exactly the same colors that I did with Todd McFarlane. Mm-hmm. It was no difference on that. But the manner in which I, did the rendering and stuff on Eric was different. Eric's stuff was extremely, you know, easy for me to color. I just sort of got how he drew and did the lighting. There's something about it. It was easier to do more rendering on. Todd was hard to render until he started adding lighting on purpose, because some of Todd's early stuff didn't have a lot of black or indication of light. He really liked it. And I said, well, you know, if you don't draw it, there's, you know, no matter what I do, the color separators are going to, you know, just ruin it. Because they're not artists. They are, you know, little old ladies with, you know, Q-tips putting globs of you know, opaque stuff down. And, you know, he started altering his stuff because he wanted all this lighting, and he would add stuff, and suddenly he got exactly what he wanted and it looked right. Because I can't draw like Todd, you know, so, you know, that, you know, that was, you know, I had to kind of convince him to put the stuff in there and I'll follow it. And then it was great. But Eric's stuff, it just always had it, you know. But I colored them exactly the same, even though they look different, but I colored them the same colors.
You colored the book that meant a lot to me when I was younger, which was DC versus Marvel, or Marvel versus DC, depending on the issue. And nope. That seems like an interesting project in of itself, because you have two different creative teams kind of per book, right? You have two different sets of pencilers and inkers. So what is it like for you as a colorist to have to try and keep it consistent throughout when you have different styles? And maybe not hugely dissimilar, but dissimilar enough.
They were massively different.
Well, I was being charitable.
No, they were massively different. You know, Dan I was accustomed to, so I knew what to do with him, but I'm trying to remember the other guy's name now.
Claudio Castellino?
Yeah. You know, his stuff drove me crazy, because it was not the sort of stuff I was good at coloring. And I had even asked Mike Carlin, I said, hey, maybe we'll get somebody else to color. And he goes, no, I want you coloring the whole project. And I went, all right. So I really struggled to get his stuff right. And I don't really know if I did. But yeah, I mean, I tried to color them with, I mean, again, you want it. My color was supposed to be the consistent thing throughout the series. And it was very difficult, because the editors kind of wanted me to try to color the characters their normal colors as often as possible, because mm-hmm. there was, you know, so, you know, and I had to have reference for pretty much every character in the Marvel and the DC universe, and every page had a gajillion characters. And, you know, let me tell you, that it was such a hard project to do. And, you know, Dan's pages I didn't have as much trouble with, but Claudio's, because, you know, his storytelling just was a little bit wonky, and his compositions made it difficult, and he would clump a bunch of red characters together, and I'd have to figure out how to solve a lot of problems with him that I didn't have to worry about so much with Dan. So, it was one of those, you're kind of happy you did it, but man, was it just hard. Mm-hmm. Same as, you know, Zero Hour was really hard, you know, but thankfully, you know, you had Jerry Ordway inking Dan on that. So the black and white was just perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, and I didn't have to fix anything. I had to figure out, how am I going to get this done when there's a billion characters everywhere? So I found creative ways of doing it that, you know, were made it a little faster for me, but still told the story a little better. I mean, there's a lot of tricks that are great storytelling tricks that are also make it a lot faster to color. So that worked out. But yeah, I did all these projects between the two companies that had just a bajillion characters. And the reason I got those characters was they could trust me to color them. You know, some people didn't do the research. I always did my research. I got it right the first time. They didn't have to be so worried that, oh my God, he didn't know who these ridiculous characters were. But I would say, I need to know reference on this, 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 and this. And Mike would have his assistant send me whatever reference I needed. The Marvel stuff I already knew, because I worked on Marvel Universe. So I, you know, I did know all the Marvel characters. But there were some, you know, characters I'd never heard of. We did it. But, you know, that was a project, let me tell you. Oof.
I'm curious what it was like. I mean, Rubenstein doing inks over, or Dan as well. I mean, obviously not one of his traditional inkers. What was it like kind of looking at those naked pencils, or sorry, naked inks, I should say?
It was great. I mean, I always liked working with Joe. Joe, when he was doing Marvel Universe and anything he inked for me, Joe was very instrumental in teaching me what the inker meant. Yeah. So, you know, Joe would give me little color notes for various colorists to explain, this is a shadow, this is a highlight, so that the colorists would do it correctly. And I'd have colorists come back at me when I was in there and say, who does he think he is telling me what to do? And I said, he's not telling you how to color. He's showing you where the highlights and things are. And I said, you can either follow them, or I will hire another colorist. Because if I'm giving you the notes, I want it this way. But it was really useful, because everybody doesn't mean the same thing with the drawing as the next guy. So sometimes things that you thought, well, that looks like it's a shadow. Nope, they meant it to be, you know, like a rim light or a highlight or something. And Joe was really good at showing me what he meant. And so then he would also try to help me decode what other inkers meant. So I used to call up the inkers and say, well, what did you mean by that? And everybody had a different answer, or every once in a while. I mean, I won't tell you their names, but there are some very prominent pencilers who had absolutely no idea what they meant by the color. No idea. They you know, they would light the figure with like 16 different light sources, and they'd say, can you uplight this? And I'm like, no, you put a shadow underneath their chin and their nose. What does that matter? I said, if you're uplighting it, there would be that would be the lightest part. So, you know, there was several, and they didn't know what they meant. I would ask the inker, I said, what does he mean? He goes, I don't know. I just inked it. I'm like, oh, so I got to figure out what this is. And sometimes I would have to color a figure two or three different times, you know, with different, you know, copies to try to figure out what does look best. Because when I would see colorists do something that just looked wrong, it would drive me crazy. I just said, geez, I really don't want any artist to look at what I did and go, well, that's obviously wrong. you know, well, I don't know what you were trying to draw there. And, you know, again, we're talking some fairly prominent artists that didn't know what they meant. You know, Tom Palmer always knew what it meant. Klaus Janson always knew what it meant. But, you know, some other people, they didn't quite know, or they didn't care. That would drive me, you know, crazy. Like, what do you mean you don't care? You know, well, just, you know, color it, because they were accustomed to, back, you know, when I started coloring, most colorists would just color the characters their natural colors, and the editors frequently wanted that, which I hated, and then they would just pick whatever colors for the background that made the character pop. And I didn't like that at all. I that's not telling a story. You know, sometimes it's supposed to be nighttime and you didn't color it that looks like nighttime. So yeah, you know, it's, yeah.
So I have two other kind of books I'll ask you about before I'll let you mercifully get back to your evening.
You can talk as long as you want. I chat forever.
I'm curious. So you were part of that team that kind of launched a new Thor ongoing. Thor had been gone from the Heroes Reborn kind of debacle, and he kind of came back and then finally was going to have his own title again. And so you're working with, you know, this time Dan's writing it, but you got JRJR doing the art. What was it like to be able to, you know, bring back to life a character like Thor, who'd been kind of off the map for a little while, and so you get to color the book, reestablish the, you know, that color aesthetic for the, you know, his world, but also like the grander Asgard as well. So, what was it like to kind of be able to redo that from the beginning, like, you know, kind of bring this book back and reestablish the visual style of Asgard?
You know, I just kind of colored it the way I would color John Jr. I mean, you know, I mean, all of the reestablishing was really done by, you know, Dan creating, you know, the new characters and whatnot. And, you know, John taking his first whack at Thor and having Klaus ink it. So, you know, I got the whole book. I mean, it's gorgeous. I just have to not ruin it. So I didn't really think, well, I want to give this its own new take on color, you know. I'm not really part of making it look any different. I just was trying to make John and Klaus look, you know, look good, which it already did. So, I just didn't want to ruin it.
Another book that
it's always fun to work on a new launch, because you get a lot more attention. There's a lot more focus. So you really don't want to mess up, because everyone's looking to, you know, everybody wanted to color that book, but I got to.
So a book I'm curious about what it was like working on was X-Men: The Hidden Years, because that had a very, very important color palette. Like, there's just something about how your colors look in that particular book that really kind of made it sing and really sold the time period that it was set in, and the kind of the aesthetic. But what was it like to take on the responsibility of coloring John Byrne?
Well, forget John Byrne, because John just did his story and did his breakdowns. He didn't pay any attention to me whatsoever. I thought John did a great job with it. Tom Palmer called me up and asked me to color the book, and I could not believe that Tom Palmer, you know, one of my, you know, really good friend of mine, but, you know, an artist I really admired and I loved his color, that he wanted me specifically to color the book, because he said, I think if you're coloring the book, we'll really have something. I thought, my God, what a compliment, you know, that is. And so I pretty much took my cues from the sort of color that, you know, when you look where the Hidden Years takes place, I went back and looked at how the books looked at that time. And I tried to use a lot of that kind of color and reference. And then I tried to like modernize it a little bit. And then I went back and looked at, you know, some of the X-Men, and that Tom had colored over Neil Adams, I guess, to try, because that was kind of that era, and try and see, well, what would Tom do here? So it was really, you know, trying to emulate what I thought Tom Palmer would do with a little more modern flair of what I would do while it's still meshing with that. And oddly, it really had nothing to do with John. I mean, John pretty much had let, he wanted Tom to sort of dominate the look of the book. And John was handling the storytelling, because I tried to talk to John about the color, and he was like, well, you know, you've got that handled. I was like, okay. But it was fun to go back and read all that stuff. And I thought what a genius idea it was to like fill in this gap that, you know, didn't, because it had to, you know, fit into the continuity. So there's stuff, you know, and I thought he did a brilliant, brilliant job. And, you know, having Tom Palmer ask for me was such a big deal. And there's a few pages that Tom colored at one point, and they sent them back to me accidentally. And I said, I'll send those back to him. He goes, oh, you can have them if you want them. I'm like, oh my God. So I have a few pages that Tom colored on that book himself, which is really nice.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yes. You know, I've been pretty lucky. I've sort of been there for so many of these big giant events, and so many people were there that I was fortunate enough to work with and be friendly with. So yeah, you know, I look back when I have these little talks, I always think, my God, I was so lucky. Not everybody, you know, got to have the mentors and friends that I had in the industry. You know, it's something.
Absolutely. You have, again, some really tremendous, you know, kind of frequent collaborators as well, that it's just incredible that to see your color art mature and also, you know, evolve, but also be able to continue to work with such amazing collaborators.
I've been very lucky.
Well, again, Gregory, thank you so much for taking your time out of your day, your busy day, to talk about, you know, your work on these various projects and these collaborations. It's been a real thrill. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, sure. Anytime. If something pops up and you want to chat about something else in specific, I'm more than happy. There's so much stuff to talk about. It's, you know, nobody ever brings up Fool Killer.
No, I guess not. Why do you think that is?
I guess because it wasn't a big selling, you know, book. It didn't have a super hot artist on it. It was one of my favorite things I got to work on because Steve Gerber wrote it. You know, I played a part in Steve's kind of reemergence at Marvel. And, you know, he also wrote, you know, I hired him to write the Nightmare on Elm Street comic that we got to do two really awesome, scary issues before Marvel executives said, oh my God, what are you doing? We're writing a horror comic the right way. You know, but it's scary. It's too much. I'm like, it's the Nightmare on Elm Street. Did you ever see the movie? So I was pretty pissed, but I've always been amused. It's like, we finally actually did something really right. Cause it was great, you know? And the inkers I had said, I wanted to look like one of those old black and white books. And they said, don't give me crap. I said, I will send it back. You know, Rich Buckler did a nice job, with the layouts, but, the inkers just, man, those pages are gorgeous. And then we had those fantastic Joe Jusco, covers. You know, Steve Gerber's work was just, it was nuts. You know, I would have loved to have continued on that one. So that was depressing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and his work on Fool Killer was just twisted and great. And then he did She-Hulk.
It almost feels like Fool Killer was maybe 10 years too early.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of really cool stuff that came out back then. I don't think people were quite ready for it. And, you know, today, you know, you could do that stuff without a problem. But now people are like, wow, you know, we need to go back and do all the comics from the 90s. No, we don't. You know, they won't sell any, you know, and, you know, there were so many terrible comics that came out in the 90s that, because it was just about product. Get product out, let's get a gimmicky cover on there and sell. Did we really need 6 Spider-Man titles, 4 Punisher titles, and I don't know how many X-Men titles? No. And, you know, I got to write some stuff that, because of that, which was nice, but, mm-hmm. you know, it was just so much, and people were buying so much of it, And then, you know, they were buying 10 issues of stuff. And I would go to conventions like, stop buying 10 issues of this comic. Go buy 10 other things. So you read 10 things, and they weren't even reading them. You know, we made money on it, but I think that was kind of the beginning of the downfall of the industry, because they weren't focusing on trying to do really cool comics that, you know, will be remembered. There's just tons and tons of material that's just another Spider-Man miniseries that had, you know, a Todd McFarlane cover on it, but an art team that you've never heard of and that we've never heard from again. Mm-hmm. That was depressing. You know, the worst thing was these gimmicky covers at Marvel. There was a few good ones. You know, there was the glow-in-the-dark Ghost Rider head was fantastic. Mm-hmm. They did the foil emboss on the Silver Surfer. That was cool. They did a foil embossed on the first Silver Sable cover, but most of these covers weren't designed to use the foil or whatever the special effect was very well. You know, the Silver Sable cover, she should have just been filling the cover so it was almost all foil. Mm-hmm. And that was like a 3D emboss, so people thought it was fun to touch her boobs. you know, I kid you not, people would comment about that. But, you know, I colored a bunch of covers. They would say, oh, by the way, figure out where to put the foil. I'm like, what are you talking about? This cover wasn't designed to really use the foil. We'll do a different cover. Mm-hmm. And it was just gimmicky cover after gimmicky cover. And, you know, unbelievably, they sold like crazy, no matter how bad it was. Mm-hmm. And that just drove me crazy. Because I finally said, you know what, I'm not coloring any more covers that are these gimmick. I just give me a nice cover. You know, because, like, you know, Scott McDaniel covers were always a ton of fun to color. I used to color a lot of the covers in my office when I was an editor, because I didn't like the way they were being colored. I wouldn't get paid for it, but then I started having creators ask me to color stuff that I was editing, and I said, well, okay, but if I did it, I couldn't get paid. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of stuff I did that's I'm really happy with, but I didn't get paid for it.
Unfortunate.
Well, again, it was the policy, so, you know, I understand that. You can't hire yourself.
No, I guess not.
Well, know, but I wanted it to look a certain way, and everybody was happy with it, so I just considered it as part of my job.
Fair enough. All right, well, again, thank you so much for taking the time, and if I do come up with a whole other series of questions or want to do a bit more deep dive into some of these, you know, color theory that you had going on in some of these books, I'll make sure to give you a shout.
Sure, anytime.
All right, will do. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks for having me.